This is Raul Lopez, and you're listening to How Do You Say Success in Spanglish? The path to success isn't easy. For minorities and people of color, many attempt this journey with little to no guidance. Join me as I sit down with individuals who share their stories of perseverance so that together we can learn how to say success in Spanglish. What's good, mi gente? Welcome back. This is your boy, Raul. Today, my guest is a very good friend of mine from college, Brenda De Los Santos. How you doing, Brenda?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm doing all right. I'm glad to you took the time, and especially now that we live so close to each other, I'm glad we had to be able to catch up and that get you on here and kind of talk about your journey as well. So just to kind of introduce you, Brenda is the owner of Brenda De Los Santos Photography in New London, Connecticut. Brenda always considered herself a creative soul, even as a child, drawing, painting, or whatever else she could find to get her hands dirty. As for photography, although she always loved it as an art form, it wasn't until 2003 she signed up for a photojournalism class on a whim while studying at Boston University. She immediately knew she was hooked and fell in love with telling people stories with photos. After working on staff at daily newspapers for several years, Brenda decided to take her photography in a different direction. Now she focuses her work on capturing the special moment in people's lives. So that's kind of cool. Being able to go and I've always liked photography. And I know the difficulties of being a good photographer. So I'm glad you're able to kind of turn your hobby, your career, your love for art into a career. So that's always very difficult to do. And we'll go into a little bit of that a little bit further. But I guess to kind of start off, just, you know, introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about you.
So aside from, you know, what you've shared, I'm a volunteer. I feel like I always share that. I volunteer in a bunch of different ways in my community. I am on the board for a local natural foods co-op. I volunteer with some photographic nonprofits. In the past, I guess since 2016, I was a big sister through the Big Brothers Big Sisters program. My little sister is grown up. She's 19 now. Other than that, you know, I love to travel. I've been very fortunate to be able to explore some countries in the past few years post-pandemic. But that's pretty much it. I'm busy a lot. Having a small business takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And so you're originally from New London, Connecticut.
Born and raised? Born and raised here. It's a little small town and I couldn't wait to get out. And I said I was going to go live in a city and never come back. And I realized how amazing it is to be 10 minutes from the ocean. And New London is a pretty cool little community. So I'm here and I love it.
Yeah, I live about 10 minutes away from New London, I think, at this point. And it's different living in a coastal town. It's a lot of pretty mm-hmm. things to look at, a lot of pretty things to do. There's so much to get involved with. You know, it's an awesome place to live. I just kind of wish it was warmer, more time of the year instead of cold. So, you know, growing up, what got you into arts and stuff? How did you get into art?
I always have loved art. I've always loved to draw. I have somewhere around here, I have a box with drawing pencils and, drawing paper and all that stuff. And I never get to use it. But I always loved art. When I was in elementary school, I was in a program that actually took me out of school on the days that my class had art, and I always missed out on it. And when I got to middle school, I kind of put my foot down and I said, no, I want to be in the art classes. And when I was in high school, I had a teacher who just really, really pushed me and allowed me to explore all different types of mediums. She allowed me to do pretty much any project I wanted, regardless of what the class was doing. And that really, I think, kind of sealed the deal for me that I knew that I would be doing something creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you were in high school and you were looking for schools, was art kind of what you were looking for at college level, or were you trying to study something else?
I didn't think that my career would be in an artistic field. I really didn't have an idea. I sort of thought maybe written magazine journalism could be fun. But I didn't think that it would be something that would be a career for me at all. I didn't know what I wanted to study when I went to college. I'm the first person in my family that went to college. So I didn't have, you know, a whole lot of, I guess I just didn't have that like guidance. And so when I got to school, I thought maybe, you know, like I said, maybe the written journalism, maybe that part of it. I even considered maybe like film and TV production. I even considered religion, which is weird because it's not, I don't know, it's not something that it doesn't make sense to me now, but it did as an 18-year-old.
No, it's, I think people don't realize sometimes, I think there's two things, you know, people don't realize 18-year-olds don't really know everything yet. And so we try to put everything in front of them and say, hey, you got to go figure out your life and figure out what you want to go to college for or work. And this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And I think we get to like the age of 30 and we still don't even know sometimes what we want to do. So, you know, it's difficult. And especially with art too, I think for a lot of people, art isn't something that is pushed as a career for most people, because every time they tell you, art is a nice hobby. Find a job that pays you enough that you can do your hobby, you know, but don't expect that you're going to make a lot of money. So it's difficult for a lot of people to encourage that. So when you were, you know, one of the things you did mention to me in the pre-interview thing is that, well, growing up, you kind of had to struggle with feelings of belonging. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was growing up, if you'd asked me what was my background, I would tell you, well, I'm Puerto Rican and Filipino. So I am what my nieces and nephews would now call a no sabo kid. I am not fluent in Spanish, and it's something that I wish was different. But I definitely had, so there's a decent size Puerto Rican and Latino community here in New London. And so at school, there were many students who were in ESL programs, students who were fluent in Spanish. And there definitely was, I feel like there were some walls between it, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have that commonality with them. Even with my family would, my cousins would say, oh, Brenda, you're white. Because I, you know, like I said, I don't speak Spanish. And so that always was kind of a thing, I feel like, as a young person growing up, that stood out to me. And even as I feel like even, you know, even going through college, there was still some of that too, but primarily when I was growing up. And then also, I certainly didn't ever feel like anyone would consider me Filipino. Spoiler alert, I am not Filipino. I did the Ancestry DNA test and I'm not.
Oh, really?
So there's that too.
Okay. You're going to have to tell me a little bit about that. How did that come up? Cause I mean, since I known you, I was always Puerto Rican and Filipino. So, you know, how first, what made you, what made you think Filipino, and how did you feel when you found out you weren't Filipino?
So one of my grandfathers is Filipino.
Okay.
He is not my biological grandfather. I didn't know that until I took the test. My family knew that. My parents knew that. But they had always told us growing up, you know, you girls, I have two sisters. So you girls are Puerto Rican and Filipino. And, you know, we grew up going to my grandpa's house and having pancit and lumpia and all of those delicious things, and have all of our family members that are Filipino. It just turns out that that grandfather is not my dad's biological father. And so as a kid, you take what your parents say for face value. And so my sisters and I all did, you know, I want to say in my early 30s, all decided we would go and do the ancestry DNA test, because we wanted to see the makeup of our, you know, our Puerto Rican ancestors. And so I remember it might have been like New Year's Day or, you know, January 2nd or 3rd of whatever year it was. And I was lying in bed in the morning and I picked up my phone and I'm scrolling my email. And I get that little ping that says your ancestry results are in. And I went and clicked on it and I looked through it and it was all very exciting to see all the different places. And then a couple of minutes later, I said, wait a minute, there's something missing there. And so I very quickly, I like 6 a.m, I'm texting my sisters and I'm like, you guys, like there's no Filipino on here. Like, what is going on? and so we talked to my mom and we talked to my aunts and they're like, yeah, no, you're not Filipino. Like,
oh my God.
And I'm like, okay. But so there's that.
I mean, I think lots of times growing up, the culture is almost as important as the bloodline. You know, like you could be, you know, I have friends who are white and they've spent years in like Latin America and are pretty much Latino, speak more Spanish than me sometimes. And, you know, they're more involved with the culture than, you know, some Latino friends that I have. And so how did that make you feel when you found out, or did you still kind of consider yourself, you know, I kind of grew up Filipino. I feel Filipino even regardless.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I still have a lot of, none of that cultural stuff is ever going to leave me. Mm-hmm. Like, I still, regardless, I grew up with Filipino grandparents on that side of the family. I have cousins and aunts and everyone who are all Filipino. It's like, that's who I was growing up. It's who I am now. I think in some, you know, in some way, like you said, like the blood doesn't matter. It's that's, you know, that's how I was raised. And then in terms of like, I feel like identifying with my Puerto Rican side or just my Puerto Rican ancestry, because that's what it is. It almost was a little bit freeing to know and to be able to say like, hey, I am like just as Puerto Rican as you. And regardless of whether or not I speak Spanish fluently enough for you, that is still who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it takes a lot for some of us, and especially as we mature. I mean, when I was growing up, I mentioned before in one of my other episodes that I had a Colombian lady that kind of yelled at me because my Spanish wasn't good, you know, and my English isn't good either, but my Spanish wasn't good. And she was like, you should be ashamed of yourself that you were born in Peru and you don't speak Spanish. And so for the majority of high school, I didn't speak Spanish to anybody. So anybody that would talk to me, like I had friends who were Colombian, who were Dominican, who were Puerto Rican, that only spoke Spanish to me. And I would speak, I would respond back in English. I would never speak mm-hmm. Spanish because I was so like ashamed yeah. and whatever. And sometimes you just kind of, you get to a point where you're like, fuck you. I don't give a shit, you know? And
yeah.
you get more comfortable yeah. and then you talk to other people and you kind of, you know, and I think a lot of the time, especially at an earlier age, for a lot of people, I think it's getting over that hump of fitting in and realizing you don't have to meet a certain checkboxes to feel mm-hmm. this way. You know, you're not Puerto Rican yeah. because you speak Spanish and you scream wepa every time something happens. You know, it's like right. there's more to it than that. So I'm glad that worked out for you. And so were you 100% Puerto Rican then, or?
As far as I know, yes. So the results have like 16 different places that I have ancestry from. The two biggest are Spanish and indigenous Taino. And I don't, my father doesn't know who his biological father is. So far, I've not found anyone through ancestry that would fit that. You know, that role. So I assume based on the mix, based on what I know from my mom's results, I believe so. But I don't know. I guess there's always a chance it could be something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's cool that you got to get some clarity on that at least. And, you know, that's the marvel of, I think, this technology and genetic testing we have now where we can kind of, it mm-hmm. makes you feel like you can put a claim on to what you are, even though you don't necessarily need to. You know, my wife, finally she took. There's funny things that we've discovered in the last couple of weeks between you and I, that your ancestry DNA results linked you to my wife's ancestry, so that you guys are related by somehow, you know, both Puerto Ricans and but she did it too because she wanted to find out where she was, because she doesn't know too much about her dad's side of the family, and she was always assuming that she had more like African ancestry because a lot of her cousins were more or dark skinned and black and things like that, and so she realized she didn't have almost any African ancestry, but a lot of Portuguese, because she was like 20% Portuguese. And the funny part was all my friends from Rhode Island are Portuguese, and they're like, you're Portuguese. So they started sending her all these Portuguese trinkets to put around the house and stuff like that. So, if you ever go to Portuguese people, they have a whole bunch of little things they always have around. They sent her like a little bowl that's shipped in fish, a little black
rooster. I have that.
You do? Yeah, yeah.
I got the bowl with the fish, and then I got a rooster all that fun stuff from when I visited Portugal a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and so they mailed all that to her to kind of welcome her as a Portuguese person. So it was fun. Yeah. And it's amazing. So I know we kind of went off a tangent on that, but you know, I think it's important to talk about it too, because I think for a lot of us sometimes, you know, not all of us are 100%. You know, like even
right.
I hate to rub it in sometimes, but my wife caught me on a technicality the other day where I would always tell my daughter she's half Peruvian, half Puerto Rican, you know? And my wife said, well, technically you're like 1/8 Italian, so she's more Puerto Rican than Peruvian. And I'm like, oh, you caught me there. So so yeah, you know, but you know, yeah, my daughter's probably going to be growing up in the future too, you know, and fitting in, and she's, you know, predominantly white area now too. So it's, you know, fitting in is something that she's going to have to work her way through as well. So, you know, I totally get it. And so when you went to college, were you able to kind of find someplace that made you feel like you fit in more?
Yes and no. My experience going to college was, I felt very, very out of place, at least my freshman year. Most of the people that I was good friends with came from very different socioeconomic backgrounds than I did. And that was like a pretty obvious difference between us. Even though a lot of my friends were people of culture, people who were not white. So we could find things that we related to in that regard. And really the big thing for me, I think, when I was in college was getting involved with Latinos Unidos, with the Latino student organization. That's how I met you.
Yeah.
And finding that community really was a big thing for me. It didn't solve everything, but it was major.
Yeah. No, I changed big time in college to where I was kind of against the idea of being Latino. I always wanted to be more black than anything, and you know, accepting who I was and appreciating my culture more. And I think Latinos Unidos, and then meeting the brothers of my fraternity, like all that just kind of drove me to do that. So you know, and it's important. And Renee, who I interviewed recently too, he mentions the importance of some of these organizations on campus to help you feel like you fit in, especially because we're always a small percentage of a college thing, and you feel like a small dot. But you did mention too that, you know, a lot of people were more affluent than I think a lot of us kind of grew up in there. And I think you mentioned something along the lines of dealing with some of that in when you started studying photojournalism.
So the photojournalism program at BU was pretty small. There were maybe like 10 or 12 of us, that were, you know, on that track within the communication school. And, so there was one other Latina in the program, and, it was not uncommon for our professors to mix up our names. So I would get called Daisy and she would get called Brenda. And I distinctly remember there was a point in, it might've been junior year, where one of our photojournalism professors made this big speech, telling us how you know, we all could afford to go to BU and our parents could are paying to send us here. So we might as well just have them buy us or open up a credit card and buy all the camera equipment. And that was just so financially unfeasible for me. My parents didn't have the money for it. I didn't have credit for it. It just made no sense to someone coming from my background. So it was something that stood out a lot. And then, like I said, a lot of my friends were people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. I remember my senior year, literally every one of my friends that I had from my freshman year, they all went on a spring break trip to Dominican Republic. And I didn't even ask my parents about it being a possibility because I knew it wasn't. And I stayed in Boston and I worked during that week and they were all, you know, having the time of their lives with like a pina colada in their hands. So
yeah,
it was fine.
Yeah. BU was interesting to meet some of the people who grew up completely different from me. And, you know, you meet them and they're like, oh yeah, we have like a $1 million home and, you know, all this stuff. And you're like, holy crap. I was like, geez,
yeah,
a completely different lifestyle. How did you handle dealing with some of those situations as far as like the different socioeconomic aspect of stuff, such as the story you're telling me with the camera and stuff like that? How were you able to handle dealing with that situation for your major?
I did what I could. We had, the thing that really worked for me was I got a job at the BU yearbook. Mm-hmm. And because I worked there, I was able to have a digital SLR that was assigned to me for the entire school year. And so that was one of the ways that I worked around it, because there was no way that I ever would have been able to purchase that on my own. And then I feel like there was a time towards the end of the year when I had to turn that camera in. And at that point I would just go and take the camera out from the photo lab and the photojournalism program.
Did they give you options to rent out equipment or borrow equipment as needed, or it was kind of a fight?
Yeah, you could borrow it for like a period of a couple of days. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like something that you could keep all the time. Fortunately, the one from the yearbook, I had it for the duration of the year until I had to hand it in. So that was something that worked, but that was something that I specifically sought out because I knew that would enable me to actually do my assignments.
Yeah. I know in college things are expensive. Everything's expensive. You know, even books are expensive. You know, electronic mm-hmm. equipment for photography is stupid expensive. You know, even now it's ridiculous. And it's always evolving and you're always trying to get the best product. So it's always hard keeping up with it. And so you have to come up with your own ways of dealing with it. I used to rent all my books from the library, from any library I could find, instead of paying for books. So you know, I'd borrow it and go through them and then return them. And, you know, sometimes I'll deal with, it was cheaper to deal with like a $30 late fee than it was to buy a whole new book, for stuff like that. So you got to make it work. And so you said you stumbled into photojournalism. What made you decide to take a class and how did that change your outlook?
You know, like I said, I always was into anything kind of creative, artistic. When I was growing up, my dad always took pictures. So I always was I had an interest in photography to begin with. And what was it? My 19th birthday, I'd asked for a film camera, just, you know, to take pictures of my friends, my family, stuff like that. And so I had a film camera and I think it was the second semester of sophomore year. I was trying to sign up for a magazine writing class and it was full by the time that it was my turn to sign up for classes. And I saw that this intro to photojournalism class was available. And I had this camera that was just sitting like, you know, like up in my closet in my dorm room somewhere. And decided to take it. And it was, you know, like I said, it was just like instant. I knew that I wanted to do it. I loved being able to, you know, to look around and be able to freeze a moment, but from my viewpoint. And so I pretty quickly decided that that was going to be my major. Mm-hmm. And it's been that way ever since.
Nice. And so when you graduated, you went into photojournalism working at newspapers?
I did. So initially I started by freelancing at my local papers here in Connecticut. And I did that for a while. And at the end of 2007, I interviewed for and got a job for the New Britain Herald and the Middletown Press. So they were like sister papers and about 20, 25 minutes apart. And so I worked at both of them, and they were both very small newspapers, which was great because in Middletown, it was only me and one other photographer, which meant that I got to go to all the assignments. It wasn't just like getting the shitty assignments that no one else wanted to do. I really got to do everything because there was no other choice. And so that really got my feet wet. I photographed murder scenes and like happy occasions, like high school graduations and profiles of people in the community. I got to photograph Obama when he was on the campaign trail. One of my favorite stories is I got to ride in a 1945 B-17 bomber plane from World War II. And I got to actually fly in that plane. And then like 2 years later, it crashed and burned in a field somewhere. So I have like some very crazy stories from that time, also some very good ones. Eventually it was summer of 2009 or 2010, somewhere around there. And all of like half of the newsroom staff at the Hartford Courant had all been laid off. And that's the biggest paper in the state, or at the time it was. And all these veteran journalists had nowhere to go. And I kind of just felt like, well, I got the experience for a few years. It was amazing, but I felt like that was the right time. And so I just jumped ship, and I worked, other regular jobs for a while and always doing photography. And eventually I got to a point where I was working pretty much full-time hours at a job at an orthodontic office doing technology computer stuff for them, and also pretty much working full-time hours on my own. And it got to be way too much. And I finally felt like I had enough regular clientele for my photography business, and I got to leave that regular job. It's been almost 10 years. It's been really amazing.
So you obviously own your own company now, your own business for photography. And so did you have to work your way up through doing freelancing and stuff on the weekends to build it till you got to the point where you felt comfortable to leave?
Yeah. It was a lot of years of after work hours, evenings, working on the weekends, taking weddings. Maybe in the first 4 or 5 years, someone asked if I would shoot a wedding that happened to be on my birthday. And like, that's like a hard no for me now, right? Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. But at that point, it was really like any job was worth taking. And I shot that wedding on August 1st of that year, and it was like 97 degrees out, and the wedding was in full sun, and everyone was like dripping buckets of sweat. And after that, I said no more, like 100% not going to do that anymore. But yeah, pretty much it was like, I really took anything that I could get. And now it's really nice because I have the freedom to say no to things, but definitely I didn't have that freedom for a long time.
Yeah. And it's scary, I think, for a lot of people to take the risk to say, I'm going to go into my own business full time. What were some of the challenges you faced once you decided to do that change?
Well, with photography specifically, or at least the photography industry in Connecticut, I mean, we have very cold winters. So pretty much after the holidays, after Christmas, all the way until the end of March is a very slow time of year. And the income is not steady, which can be really challenging. Right now we're in the busy time of year, and sales are coming in and things are great. But I don't know that if you talk to me 3 months from now that I would say the same thing. Mm-hmm. So as a business owner, you have to be mindful of that, and you have to kind of plan for that downtime. And it can be a lot, but it works out if you plan right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, budgeting's got to be really important, I guess, for dealing with your money for the rest of the year. So what are some of the resources that you've had to go to help you, succeed?
So I really have worked on building community. So I am very much naturally an introvert. Mm-hmm. And as someone that works by myself all the time, that's can be not a great combination. So I have made myself step out of my comfort zone, have gone to different business groups, different networking groups to try and make connections. That's actually one of the best things I did. I think back in 2016, I started going to a group called Rising Tide, and have made some of my best business connections from that group. So really, I think it's about finding community, especially as someone in a field where typically you're a single person business. Mm-hmm. So you have people that you can fall back on. If I were to have, if I had an emergency and I couldn't make it to shoot a wedding, I have a community of people that I can rely on to, to find coverage for me and to make sure that my clients' most important days are covered. So that's like number one. But also that community brings experience, and it's really important to have other people who have been in your shoes and have been where you are to get advice from. I didn't always have that. I feel like starting out, it was really hard because there was a lot more of a sense of competition among photographers in the area, or at least that's what I perceived. And I didn't really have anyone that I could go to when I had a problem with a client or a difficult situation that I needed to kind of work through. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard and very isolating. And especially there were not many people of color that I could lean to. So really, I have found that you have to build that community, and I've been working on that.
Nice. So are you becoming one of those like mentors now towards the younger generation of photographers in Connecticut?
I really try to. I have a young man who is a high school senior at one of our local high schools, and I am mentoring him for a senior project currently. And I typically always try and look out for, my fellow Latino photographers, any photographers of color, because I don't want them to have it how I had it when I started out.
Yeah. No, that's good. And it's hard. Yeah. I think a lot of us are in the same boat where it's like, it feels we're running through this by ourselves, and we'll either be the change we need to be, or we just let everybody else suffer. So I'm glad that you're doing that. I mean, you've always been a good person like that. So so when you were starting your business, did was there ever a point where you were kind of like, shit, did I do the right choice? Like, am I going through it? There's always going to be struggle, but did you ever second guess it for a little bit, and how'd you overcome that?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like I still feel that way once in a while. Especially, like I said, come back to talk to me in February. I think especially with photography, it doesn't seem like it, but it's a pretty physical job. I don't think that like 20 years from now, I want to be running around, schlepping tons of equipment at weddings. So I do think about, what would be an exit plan or an alternate plan. I don't have any intention of using those plans anytime soon. But definitely there are times where like, this is a very hard path. And I don't know why. Why don't I just work a regular 9-to-5 job where I could go home and I would be home and not feel guilty that I'm not working on, you know, like the 5 sessions that need to be edited by X date. It's a lot, especially this time of year. Right now we're in my busy season. Busy season is really September through the beginning of December here in Connecticut. And I don't know when my last day off was.
It's tonight and you're talking to me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So do you find it difficult to balance that work-life balance at all?
I try really hard to be as balanced as possible. There are some times when it's just not possible. So like I said, right now, this time of year, it's, you know, the reality is that I have, you know, 4 weddings sitting in my editing queue, along with, you know, maybe like 15 or so sessions that need to get delivered. And I also have to maintain my website and maintain my social media presence and, you know, do all of that back end of stuff. This time of year, it's kind of just, I grind and I work. And then I know that in the wintertime, in the springtime, I'm going to have a lot more time to spend with family and friends. And I really, really make use of that time when I have it.
Nice. And so the big part of all of this too, that I'm noticing, is you're doing a lot of this stuff on your own. You do the editing, the socials, the things like that. Are most people who are in photography go that route, or is the goal to grow big enough that you can do one aspect of that without doing the rest?
I think it depends. Everyone has different business models. I have a very good photographer friend who outsources most of her editing. And she has a team of photographers who shoot weddings for her business. I don't desire to have that. I like that I have a pulse on every single client's galleries and wedding images. And I like working on my own most of the time. Yeah. So one of the things, I am always looking for ways to work smarter, put it that way. So in the past couple of years, I've implemented some of the different AI technologies that are around for photography. So I actually use AI to cull my images. So when I come home from a wedding with 4,000 photos, I run it through this program and it will narrow it down to 1,000 for me. And then I review those to make sure that the technology is doing what it needs to do properly, but it saves me hours. Mm-hmm. So I try to work as smart as possibly. I try and stay up on technology. I think for photography, you really have to do that. And if you're not, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat with you with a lot of the stuff. You know, I'm doing this as a side right now. Yeah. And it's if AI hasn't helped me cut down my video sometimes to edit it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, let me look at that clip. All right, change it a little bit, move a little bit here, and boom, as opposed to, you know, what I thought was going to be like hours of video editing and cutting out stuff to make a YouTube clip, you know. So it's taking advantage of technology, and AI is crazy now. It does so much.
Like, it does.
It's just it's amazing and scary at the same time. So it's coming. It's going to take all over from us. So, you know, for someone who's looking to turn a hobby or their art into a business, you know, what is something you would tell them if they were interested in doing that?
Yeah, I have a lot of people that I have worked with over the years who want to do that and have done it. The first thing that I encourage is, number one, before, like, don't just grab a camera and then say, oh, I'm going to go shoot someone's wedding. Don't do that, because you're setting yourself up for failure. I encourage people to learn to use, you know, their equipment in and out. practice a lot, photograph lots of friends and family. And then once you've done that, figure out what you need to do to make it legal. So, you know, figure out what you need in order to pay your taxes, what you need in order to be profitable. That's, I think, for people who are in it for the artistry, it can be a really foreign concept. So one of the things that I do, I have photographers that I mentor to help them start or grow their businesses. And that's one of the first things I always say is, let's run your cost of doing business. Like, let's figure that part out. Because you can, you know, you might be able to say, oh, well, I'm going to charge people, you know, this little amount of money because that's how, what I feel that I'm worth at that beginning point in your journey. But if you're not making a profit, it's still just a hobby. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is you have to learn the business side of it. And I think for people that are in it because they love photography and they love creating beautiful images, that's not the first thing they think of.
Yeah. It's a give and take, I think, for a lot of people. A lot of people jump in thinking, mm-hmm. oh, I get to do art I love. And then eventually it's also a job and you got to treat it as a job as well. So no, that's good advice. And I've seen a lot of people who buy, I think it's more prevalent now. And I don't know if you feel this way, but do you feel like sometimes everybody with a camera now wants to act like they're a photographer and it dilutes the product for your business?
I think to some degree, sure. I'm definitely in, I don't buy into a scarcity mindset. I think that there are clients for everyone. I think that photography realistically, like, is a luxury service. It's, you know, it's not something that people absolutely need. So I know that, when I have clients that book me, that it's, you know, it took my hard work and years of what I've been doing to get there. And I'm very appreciative of it. But there are tons of folks out there who buy a camera and are like, I'm your photographer now, like, call me up. Yeah. And that's okay. It's all right. Probably the people that are gonna have them be their photographer, they're probably not my clients.
Yeah. So, I think so. When I used to do graphic design, in college, you know, there was a guy who was talking to me about, you know, pricing, and he was like, charge the amount you think you're worth. Don't charge what you think you need for the job. So, you know, if they're willing to pay for you, they'll pay for you. If not, then it's not worth your time. And that's not who you're looking for. And I think that's the hard balance, especially like when you're starting off, where it's like, you're trying to just get whatever you can to get that skill up. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you got to get past that point and say, well, I can't do it at this price the rest of my life. I have to eventually, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years now. My price point goes up a bit. And do you ever have to deal with people who, what's it called? They pay you with, what's the word? You know, they're like, oh, I'm a big person. And if you do this,
I'll average an exposure.
There we go. Yeah. You know, do you ever have to deal with that? And how do you deal with that?
I used to have to deal with that. Years ago, I haven't really gotten too much of that at this point, which I'm very thankful for. Mm-hmm. Most of the time I would just very politely decline, because, you know, if it's not making me money, it's not making me money. I like, my time is valuable. But I think as a newer photographer, it's harder to stand firm when you're presented with that situation. At this point, there was a couple of years ago, someone that was basically this exact scenario, who owned a social media marketing company and wanted product photos for a certain, you know, for one of his clients, and wanted to pay me, I don't know, like $200 for this, a big shoot with tons of final images delivered for like multiple hours of my time. And I very nicely told them, I said, well, my normal rate for this is that. So if you want to, you know, if you want to pay my regular rate, like, I'm happy to work with you. And he was like, and he came back and said, no, our client can only pay this much. And I said, okay, well, that's great. It doesn't sound like we're a good fit. But best of luck. And it took a while to get there, to be confident enough in myself to turn someone down. But it's pretty wonderful to feel that way and to know that I can say no to things.
Yeah, it's I think 9 out of 10 times when someone's trying to offer you exposure, it's never really going to be worth it. Especially nowadays, mm-hmm. I think everybody and their mother be like, "Oh, I got 1,000 followers," and it's like, "Yeah, that's not
yeah,
it's not." And then that's really going to turn around.
Yeah,
and it's a little hard, I think, early on in your career where you're just kind of like, "Oh, yeah, I could really use exposure right now," and it's like, just be careful, you know, don't get taken advantage of. And so, you know, you go back, you go through this whole journey and everything you've done. You know, if you could go back in time and, you know, talk to a younger version of Brenda and give her some advice, what's something you'd tell yourself?
I probably would tell myself to say no more often, because there were, like I said, that working that 97 degree wedding on my birthday was not where it's at. Mm-hmm. I definitely would remind myself that, you know, you're always going to feel imposter syndrome. And I think that probably applies to everyone in every industry there is, mm-hmm. but especially so when you're making art, that you always feel like your work is not good enough. And it's very easy to compare yourself to others, and don't do it. You don't have to compare yourself to others because you are you. And like, you're enough, just how you are.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And then I guess, you know, finally, you know, this is, how do you say success in Spanglish? And everybody has their own definition of success. So how does Brenda say success in Spanglish?
My success is being able to do what I love, which I'm doing, having enough time with friends and family, which I need to work on, but I'm trying to get there, and being able to give back while I'm doing all of that.
Nice. Wonderful. Well, Brenda, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time out today, which, like I said, you're probably your one free night, and I took advantage of it. But thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your insight. You know, I definitely hope that have you on some more with some more feedback, and you know, get you on a couple more resources available to help out as well. And I definitely want to get involved with your Rising Tide thing as well, since I'm so close as well. So, is there anything you want to push out from your end, your website?
I mean, if there are anyone that's local-ish or anyone that wants to hire a photographer to travel to you, I do that. I've traveled to Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and all over the United States, so I'm happy to travel and do that. My website is just brennadelosantos.com, so check me out.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And for everyone else listening in, once again, I appreciate all the support, and I hope you'll join me again next time as we continue to learn how to say success in Spanglish.